solver for these correlators, right, which wouldn't actually go through realizations. But it turns out that you can never make this work work in practice. So we're stuck with these essentially Monte Carlo simulations, which have some sort of random initial conditions. Okay. So normally, if we don't have sufficient signal to noise, or if we are limited by sample variance in one initial particular initial conditions, we either run a larger simulation, or maybe we run multiple smaller simulations with independently created initial conditions. Okay. Now the question is, if we can do better, if we can learn something by running basically multiple simulations that have no cleverly set up collated initial conditions, so that we can so that we can do things with it. And this is one such proposal that we studied, in which is to run pairs of simulation with inverse initial conditions. And by inverse initial conditions, I simply say you take a delta field in your initial conditions and you invert it into minus delta field. Okay. So because this is just multiplying by minus one, it's actually true both in real and Fourier space. And what it means that over densities in one, so you have two simulations. One has inverted initial conditions. And you evolve both of them forward to some sort of nonlinear regime. But it means that overdensity in one simulation corresponds to underdensity in the other simulation. So once you go to the evolved field, it means that halos in one simulation correspond to the voids in the other. Okay. On large scales, you expect the thing to evolve linearly, so exactly equal and opposite up to minus sign. But the small scales will decorrelate. Okay.
Why
do you want to do it? Okay, we're getting there. Okay. So this was done with Andrew Pons of UCL, and we actually ran a pair of such initial conditions with the 200 megaparsecs, 512 cube, something fairly small, not very crucial. And this is how this looks in practice. Okay, so this is the original simulation at redshift zero. We identified some halos, which are some real massive halos here are red, some lots of massive halos here are green. Okay, you track these halos back to initial conditions, and now they correspond to this somewhat amoeba-like structures. You inverse the initial conditions, and then you evolve further, and then basically what are halos in one thing corresponds to kind of these void-like things in the other thing, right? And you can actually see how this nice correspondence work, right? So basically this big void here, being like this, has been transformed into this kind of massive structure like this, and so on. So in a way, you can say, okay, this is the most natural definition of what a void is, and this was really the initial motivation for this. But I think we can do other things which I think are in a way cooler.
Is that how the question is defined? Is defined void? Is that what you
said? This was initial motivation, but I think we moved beyond that. Okay. So one thing you can do, you can cross correlate the forward and reverse initial conditions. Okay. And then this is roughly what you get. So this is as a function of redshift. You start at sort of higher redshift, going to redshift of zero. The dotted line is the simulation going, is the linear power spectrum, linear evolved power spectrum. The red line is the auto power spectrum of each of them. And you see it blows up in the power spectrum due to nonlinear structure formation. And this line going down is the minus of the cross power spectrum. Okay, and you see the cross power spectrum evolves linear large scales, but then starts to kind of decorrelate, right? So the small scales kind of move away from where we were. Okay. Now, what you can try to do is say, okay, can I make predictions for this cross power spectrum? How fast it falls down with power? Okay. And if you go to the old school, SPT RPT, it's clear what happens, right? So in SPT, you expand the field in terms of kind of powers of density field, okay, where nth order correction gets kind of contributions from n deltas in the initial conditions, okay. So it means that if you look order by order, all the odd orders flip sign, all the even orders don't when you compare the standard simulation and the inverse simulation. Okay. So this means that basically if you write the power spectrum, which in SPT or RPT and this family of things looks something like P11, plus, you know, P13, P22, P15, and you organize it in some sort of like P11, and I put 13, 15, and 7, and so on, P1x, P22, P24, P26, and P2x, and so on. Then it turns out that out of power spectrum of initial condition is just P11. The initial conditions times final is P11 plus 1/2 P1x. The standard is P11, P1x, P2x, P3x, etc. But if you do standard cross reverse, basically all P11, P1x, P3x, and so on flip signs. Okay. And what you can do, you can essentially measure these things, right? And with measure things, you can actually solve for up to 4 quantities out of this thing.
What was R
there? R is reverse. Okay. So reverse is this other simulation.
So then what was I see
then? Initial conditions.
Just initial, okay.
Okay. So the initial condition standard is initial condition solved to standard, and R is initial minus initial condition solved to R, right? Okay. And then the first thing you can do, you can say, okay, say in the old days you didn't have this thing, so with 3 quantities you can solve for, with 3 measured quantities you can solve for 3 things here, like P11, P1x, and P2x. And of course, this is okay. One more thing that's interesting to note here. You know, in SPT there was this funny coincidence that P13 and P22 were essentially exactly equal but opposite, nearly, so they nearly canceled each other, right? In this case, suddenly instead of canceling each other, they add to each other, right? And this is the main reason why this thing falls down much faster than autocorrelation goes up, right? But anyway. In the old school, you could solve for P13 and P22 from these 3 quantities, and this is something like what you would get. These things are the things measured from simulation, and you see this is P13, this is P22. It doesn't look too good, neither in SPT and RPT. But now we have this extra power spectrum. You can solve for this contaminating thing, which is P3x, and you get 4 quantities, right? So this is now P13, this is P22. And the green line is P3x, okay? And for all the abuse that kind of this SPT and RPT gets, which I agree that they're really conceptual problems, it seems to work surprisingly well. You know? In particular, you see that if you go to very large scales, this extra component effectively wants to be 0, okay? And there was no need to be. It just means that effectively all these power spectra on large scales do seems to satisfy certain consistency conditions, right? The other thing you can see is that the dotted line is SPT and the dashed line is RPT predictions. But actually, these things work surprisingly well, okay? I mean, when this P3 term starts growing up, they break down, as you can imagine, right? But up to here, it seems to, within noise, it does work surprisingly well, okay? Yeah, this Croce, Scocimaro thing, yeah. And basically, we just took this copter thing, and which calculates all these predictions. I didn't even like spend too much time. Okay. Now, another quantity that you might be interested in is simply let's just look at the shape of this suppression. Okay. So this is the P cross. So this is minus P cross, basically standard times reverse divided by P auto. Okay. And this is again a different redshifts. Okay. So this is. This is the redshift of 9, the auto redshift of 0, okay? And then you see that the different lines are again different perturbation theory predictions. And so again, this is RPT, works quite well. SPT works a bit shitty. This is my attempt at the LPT, might still be wrong, I'm not sure, but in a way I would expect LPT to work better here. But so maybe this is just wrongly plotted. But you see, it works, but kind of, not perfectly, and the reason why it doesn't seem to work as well as here is simply precisely because I'm really going to like really, really strong suppressions here, 10 to minus 2. Okay. Now another thing, but you can find the fitting function. Okay. And this is a simple 2 parameter fitting function. So I'll give you a second, right? And you see it goes like bang to kind of or k of two. Admitted that very, very high redshift, but even here kind of low redshift, it works surprisingly well. Okay. And this fitting function, the thing I tried it out of just curiosity is something of this thing, which is e to the minus k to some power, okay? And the nice thing is that at redshift 9, this fitted power wants to be basically 2 to like 5 significant figures, okay? So this really means that this suppression, right, is just Gaussian, you know, exactly as you might kind of naively expect to like kind of extremely, extremely high accuracy, okay? And of course, none of the standard preparation theories can capture this. So obviously, there's like a deeper reason for this. And you might think, okay, this is the most idiotic thing to fit for. So, but I've tried something like this, and like formula of this kind, which you kind of argue it makes more sense. You know, that doesn't give fit any better, right? So clearly you have like a Gaussian period, but it becomes kind of a little bit on Gaussian.
Does it make you just have like an Maxtonian velocity, random velocity distribution?
Well. Yeah, something like that. I would expect kind of the first order LPT would give the right answer, but no.
But none of them have a random component. The perturbation theories, they're all, I guess, deterministic. So if there's a realized component, then that would look more like a Maxwell.
Okay, I'm not so sure, right? This is.
No, but they don't have any random components.
Okay.
I mean, Anyway,
I guess it'd be interesting to see what EFT has to say about this, right? So I think it's just kind of a nice tool to, I'm looking at Leonardo now, to test these theories, right? So just a quick note that this is really, it's a special case of transformation, right? Where you can take initial conditions and you multiply by anything that effectively just kind of phase rotates the thing. And you get another valid initial conditions draw from the same, they're equally likely initial conditions, right? And then initially I thought, okay, this is great. You know, instead of multiplying by minus one, I can multiply by I, say, or I over four, okay? So basically just flip the real and imaginary part, okay? And then naively you would think you can like pull out all orders, right? But of course you break the reality condition, right? So unless you work out how to run complex simulations, this is not going to work, right? But of course, this is the thing we play, and then you have like other ones like translation, right? So there's an entire family of like phase rotations like this for which you can then you can make predictions, okay? Another thing which is interesting about this, which is again we're thinking about. So you take the two initial conditions, right? They have the same realization of the power spectrum, okay? So the power spectrum it's exactly the same. The realization in the box of the power spectrum is exactly the same, but the bias spectrum is equal and opposite, okay? So and you think if a weakly nonlinear scale is the bias spectrum, it's the dominant force, then you might think. Basically, instead of getting rid of sample variance by running many of those simulations, you can just run pairs of them. You know, one with initial conditions, one the inverse initial conditions. So you're going to converge to the realization mean faster. Okay, but again, you need to run twice of them, so it's not clear whether this helps or not. Okay, but before going to that direction, let me give you another intriguing plot about this. So what I plotted here is I took the power spectrum of the first simulation, right? So SS, okay, which has certain initial conditions, and then I subtracted the power spectrum of the RR, okay? So the difference between power spectra and divided by the mean of the power spectrum, okay? So this is interesting because, you know, usually when these simulators, when they run some sort of simulation, you know, so they measure some power spectrum, right? And it's all jagged on large scales because of the sample variance, okay? And then they multiply it by, you know, so they P measured and then multiplied by, you know, the P linear divided by, you know, P initial conditions realization, right? To make it kind of smooth, okay? And if this is a valid thing, then basically the power spectrum, my SS and my RR should be exactly the same, right? And you can see you can get fractional differences up to, you know, 10%, which persists to like super super small scales, right? And I was really surprised about this. It definitely makes this kind of thing procedure slightly worrying, right?
What is happening here? So these two are supposed to be exactly the same.
They have exactly the same. The initial conditions are the same and opposite, right? So the the power spectra, it's exactly the realization's power spectrum is exactly the same, right? The realization of bispectra is.
The largest can literally be zero, right?
No. So these are 200 megaparsec things. So even the largest scale is not absolutely linear, right? At 200 megaparsecs, you already get at redshift zero, you get significant nonlinearities. Okay.
Okay. So you see, these are just within a linear. So you get, yeah. If just linear, this would be zero.
So definitely this will get down to this will get lower if you go to larger boxes. Okay. This is a box dependent statement. Okay. What I'm surprised is basically, so I would expect some crap here, but basically at this small k, I would think you're completely not, there's no sample variance, right? But it seems to be like this large scale small do feed in surprisingly low, okay? Then we said, okay, let's try a third thing, okay? How much time do I have?
Still got about
Oh, wow, okay, so I have plenty of time. So I'll probably finish soon, okay? So then, So then we said let's try a third thing, okay? And third thing is to run a simulation where we actually flip the sign up to a certain scale, but didn't add the scale above that, okay? Which is again to see how the scales propagate, and then we can get plot like this. And I also think this is kind of interesting plot to look at, okay? So again, the red line here shows you the linear, the nonlinear power spectrum, the plus nonlinear power spectrum, okay, and I also showed the minus nonlinear power spectrum, okay, times k squared, I think, in order to make things look nice, and then we had this thing that flips signs. You can either correlate it with the first one, where you get something that's like positively correlated on large scales, and then flips to being negatively correlated on small scales, okay. Or you can cross-correlate with the inverse one, which now it's negative correlated on large scales and then positive correlated at small scales, okay? At least initial conditions, right? But the entire point is that here you have like this massive, massive step, but this massive step is virtual. There's no, like initial conditions are still like perfectly valid realization, right? You just flip some signs of some modes, okay? Now see what happens as you evolve these things, okay? So this thing that has like the same large scale mode, but equal and opposite small scale mode, okay? Basically, as it evolves with the time, it takes this negative cross correlation and just pulls it out, right? I also it's really surprising. Like this sine line, as you approach redshift zero, becomes effectively goes above zero, right? So it means that this large scale mode effectively pull this thing to like seems to be the large scale mode actually dominate and bring this power positive, right? Now, if you go to the opposite direction, you lose everything, right? So this thing that was kind of positively correlated here then just kind of slowly disappears, okay? So it seems like as long as large-scale modes correlate, you they will propagate to small scales, but not the other way around, okay? So this is kind of another interesting idea when you can actually, it's kind of a toy where you can test how this information about these things propagates throughout the simulation, okay? So this is my inverse simulation project. But now that I still have plenty of time, I'll talk about what I really said I will talk about, which is the large scale bias in the laminar forest. Okay. In BOS, we were finally able to measure the 3D collision forest. Okay. Because it's for the first time we have 160,000 quasars, right? We robustly measure large scale biasing parameters B delta and beta. And of course, long term we want to be able to unify 3D and 1D power spectrum measurements. And the reason is why, and to do this, we want to be able to use the full shape of 3D power spectrum in the same way as we use the P1D, right? So at the moment we're at the level where you can use the P3D to measure BAO of a laminar forest. But long term, we really want to use it in the same way as you say galaxy power spectrum, etc. Okay. Sorry.
What is
B8? It's this B8. Okay. Okay. Where eta is DVD. It's basically this is Lyman alpha speak. We use so eta is DVDR. Okay. So before I carry on, let me just go through one to quickly for the kind of non-aficionados of Lyman forest. What does Lyman forest really measure? Okay, so absorption is done by neutral hydrogen photonization equilibrium, which essentially says the number of recombinations is the same as number of photonizations. Okay, so the number of neutral hydrogen dense, the number density of neutral hydrogen atoms scales something like baryon density squared, okay? Which means that the absorbed flux fraction, which is what you really observe, is e to the minus tau. So something e to the something proportional to the rho b squared, only it's slightly less than squared because of the temperature dependence of recombination coefficient, okay? The bottom line is that we're observing a very nonlinear transformation of the underlying density field, okay? So on one hand, it means on small scales, the physics can be understood from first principles. And I really think this situation is much better than saying galaxy, because we have saying, when you try to understand like galaxy biasing, you have really have a lot of nonlinear physics. But here, if your line of sight goes to some sort of dense region, the flux is zero. And otherwise, you just look at this kind of slightly heated up, slightly nonlinear gas, okay? But more important, on large scale, some alpha 4 is simply a bias tracer in the same way as galaxies are bias tracers and so on. Basically, this is a local transformation, so you get a bias tracer on large scale, okay? So for local transformation, you expect the delta F is B delta, like the delta bias density times delta plus B eta plus B gamma. Well, delta gamma here is some sort of photonization fluctuations, right? So you take all the fields that matter on large scales. Plus some sort of noise term, which is white, okay? And here, this is your eta, right? dV parallel by dr, okay? Note that equivalently for galaxies, B eta is 1, okay? Since numbers are conserved when you do RSD transformation, okay? So if you go to real space, redshift space, because the number of galaxies is conserved, B eta is 1, but in Lyman forces, it's really a free parameter, okay? And basically, a big background split tells us basically that B delta is just response of mean flux to a kind of change in background density, like running slightly close to universe, right? And B eta is just the change in mean flux in response to change in kind of background kind of change in some of DC kind of k equals zero eta mode, okay? And then, of course, this gives us this power spectrum as always. Okay.
So is eta really one for galaxies?
Yeah, it's one for galaxies.
And because number is conserved, but I mean, you could have the galaxies that go in and out of your observation threshold. So because of the redshift.
This is just Kaiser formula, right?
Right. No, I'm just wondering what happens if you.
I think this is small effect, right? But this is kind of definitely an observational effect. Like,
what I don't understand is that you said both of these are nonlinear probes of the underlying density field.
Yes.
Do you think there's something that's different about galaxy formation?
No. All I'm saying, like basically, if I see in real space and I go from real space to redshift space, I move galaxies radially, right? So in some sort of volume, large volume, the number of galaxies will be conserved. Okay. If I do the same Lyman alpha forest, you have some tau field, the number of neutral hydrogen, right? So I go from this space to redshift space. I move the neutral hydrogens around, right? So the total density of neutral hydrogen, the total number of neutral hydrogen atoms is conserved, right? But the mean flux changes, okay? Because suddenly now e to the minus tau, just that there's no reason for that to be conserved, right? That's why. I'll go to that in a second. No, but then you get to these things like, you know, there are these these people who did for Lyman alpha emitters, you get exactly the similar Kaiser formula due to this radial transfer effects, okay? And this is precisely for the reason you're telling us, okay? So these parameters were measured like years ago using 40,000 quasars in this paper, Kai Push, we did in 2014. And here we measured the correlation function, monopole, quadrupole, hexadecapole, and so on, okay? And then you can feed them with these formulas. And we measured these two numbers, BF, which was 0.336, like this combination where B is now the Kaiser beta parameter, right? It's actually the ratio of the two Bs, was something like that. And B flux was measured much worse than that. Okay, now at the time it was clear that basically if you do kind of back of the envelope calculation, this was inconsistent with what you extrapolate for P1D, okay? Because the P1D is simply the integral of P3D. So if you take something like McDonald 2006 measurement and try to convert them to what bias factors this implies, it was inconsistent. And that's why some people thought maybe we're seeing photonization fluctuations and so on, okay? But then, like, Blomqvist et al., we reanalyzed the latest data of this kind, okay? And then it turns out that with the latest 160,000 quasars, this number is essentially unchanged. What I want to say? Okay, I'm missing words here. So what was shown here is that in Blomqvist et al., effectively the line alpha forest fluctuations are non-linear. So to get this number, we fit it with distances bigger than megaparsecs, assuming they're linear. And it turns out that basically this was a bad approximation. These line alpha forest fluctuations really only become linear at distances bigger than the 20 megaparsecs. And then if you fit with the latest data, distance is bigger than 20 megaparsecs, something we couldn't do in 2012 because we didn't have enough signal to noise, then these things move significantly, like up to 2.7 sigma, right? And these things are now much more consistent with P1D, okay? So the bottom line is for aficionados of these things of P1D versus P3D, things really are P1D now, it's in perfect agreement with P3D as long as this kind of consistency of these bias parameters is concerned, okay? Sorry? What? You're still talking about beta, no?
No, if I compare the BF that you were just pointing to the BF from the first line, it's like, isn't that like a minus? It changed by 0.17.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, sorry. So, yeah, the difference between this, I didn't expect to come this far, right? With this talk, that's what it is. So I haven't looked at these slides for ages. Like the difference between this BF and this BF is because they're evaluated at different redshifts. This is simply like that's actually really well spotted. This is evaluated. One is evaluated redshift like 2.5, and the other is 2 or something like that. Okay, so these BF numbers are consistent. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. So this BF you shouldn't compare with this BF with this BF. Basically, if you go to this paper, the bottom line is that basically this combination is always not measured that well to make much difference. But this thing was really really well measured. Okay, and this is that has shifted by like 2 sigma to make like P3D and P1D come into agreement. Okay. There was an interesting paper. What I really want to talk about is this interesting paper in 2011 from Urosh, who did these analytical predictions for these bias parameters. Okay, and he did analytical predictions for both B delta and B eta. What's interesting about this prediction is they link the flux PDF. So these averages you see here are average over the probability distribution function for flux. With actually what you expect to be on large scale bias parameters, okay? And here he assumes some sort of FGPA, and this new tool is simply a second like perturbation theory, like average kernel, okay? So it's just a magic number, okay? Now this is potentially very interesting, right? Because if this actually worked, right, it means you could use combination of measurements of flux PDF and large scale structure to infer numbers are A and alpha straight from the data. But also the other thing, because now suddenly, you know, when you do red space distortions from galaxies, we can measure the F sigma 8. We can measure F sigma 8 because we know the B eta is 1. We can't do the same thing for lambda alpha force because we don't know what beta is, but if you could constrain it using these flux PDFs, you could do this and then it would be great, okay? But it's also potentially very, very wrong, right? Especially because the expression for B delta is based on the second order perturbation theory. And we know that the lambda alpha flux kind of comes from very, very small small scale. So this looks like it's going to be extremely wrong, okay? And basically the expression for B, it assumes no thermal broadening, okay? But we show that this is effectively, we rederive this expression in a different way, and you can show that in the limit of no thermal broadening, this is effectively exact, right? Which I think it's interesting result, but it turns out that thermal broadening is significant, okay? So a quick note on this B eta, right? So standard derivation of Kaiser formula relies on Jacobian transformation, okay? When you do something, you say, well, 1 plus delta S dS is 1 plus delta R dR, and then you do this Jacobian transformation, and you get Kaiser right space distortions out, okay? And it turns out that this works, but it's kind of, if you actually look, it just works for the wrong reasons, right? The approximations you do are not at all well controlled, okay? A better derivation of Kaiser distortions is simply to note that the B eta is really a response of the mean density of some sort of large scale eta at fixed delta equals zero. And since we know that eta is dvdr, the action of just adding a constant eta, it's nothing but just kind of like stretching of your coordinates, okay? And so it turns out that for conserved tracers, b eta equals one. So what happens, if I take the part of a universe, I go to the same part of the universe with some sort of underlying eta, it takes this part of the universe and it's going to stretch it a little bit, okay? So the galaxies inside are not going to like, the total number of galaxies is exactly the same, but now you stretch them over the volume, which is longer by 1 plus theta, right? So if you take this derivative, you get exactly 1. And this is the real reason why B eta for galaxies is 1, okay? Now, if you apply for the same tracer for Lyman alpha forest, you can say, okay, here I take the same thing is happening to the number of neutral hydrogen atoms. So my tau field is divided by 1 plus eta. But then you can kind of expand this over PDF, and it turns out that B eta is F ln F, where this is just average over the flux PDF. Okay. Now, of course, this argument it's exact only in the limit of no thermal broadening, right? If you have thermal broadening, as you go to this region of the universe when you have eta action, the thermal broadening kernel stays the same, right? While you actually extend the universe, which breaks this argument, right? But I'm still excited because I thought, well, maybe the thermal broadening effect is not that big, so this will actually work surprisingly well. Okay. So we've done this test on simulations using some sort of simulations of 40 megaparsecs. We smoothed to give this theory the best possible chance. We simply took the baryon field, we smoothed it. Okay. We calculate tau by this construction. We calculate flux. Okay. And then we calculated bias either using peak background split kind of calculation, i.e. running three simulations, one overdense, one underdense, and take derivative, or just direct, you know, kind of cross power spectrum divided by outer power spectrum, okay? And this is the results we have, and this is as a function of smoothing scale. So this is the smoothing scale in megaparsecs for the reality test, say R of like 0.2 or 0.3, it's like what you should apply, which is close to the real data. And this is B delta flux. The points are results from this peak background split kind of simulation. And these red and the points with arrow bars are from like direct kind of cross power spectrum by the outer power spectrum. And what you see here is that this, if you go to real space, this Urashi's second order perturbation theory formula just seems to work like magic, right? I expect it to be kind of accurate, kind of 10-20%. It seems to be like bang on, right? Okay, that's really impressive for the reasons which are beyond my understanding why exactly it works so well. Okay, and then even if you go through this is the real space, red is the redshift space, and blue is the redshift space with thermal broadening. Your predictions for B eta seems to work surprisingly well over all this large range, at least in the limit of this FGPA. Okay. If you go for this other parameter B eta, okay, If there is no thermal broadening, you see that these analytical predictions are exactly bang on, right? As you expect, because we said that they're going to exact, right? But as soon as you add thermal broadening, they move a lot, right? And they move by kind of large factor, okay? So it does seem like the thermal broadening is like really responsible for breaking these otherwise exact predictions, which kind of breaks my daydream idea of like being able to measure F sigma 8 from laminar forest. Okay, and then.
So these are not real simulations, these are just specific backgrounds.
No, they're real simulations.
No, they're real simulations. Okay.
They're real simulations, but because I can't afford to run kind of like 400 megaparsec hydro simulation, I run three simulations. I run one simulation, one slightly closed simulation, one slightly open simulation, right? And this allows me to simulate the presence of large scale over density thermal density, right?
To find the bias,
right? But to cross-check, I simply checked. The reason is that this is actually quite tricky to make work in practice because the time mapping from redshift and so on changes, so you need to do, it takes some time to get right. And we still have some issues here, right? Okay, and I'll stop here. Okay, I scared everybody.
So you think, I guess I'm trying to understand what is this approximation that works very well. So this is some sort of Lagrangian perturbation theory?
No. This is really just kind of SPT kind of theory, okay?
Standard perturbation theory.
The reason why I think it works so well is basically it's really the calculation for this bias parameter is again it's peak background split kind of calculation, right? Okay, so he said let's see how the small scale, let's see how delta responds to presence of large delta, okay? And I think the reason why it works so well is that if you take initial conditions, right, and try to predict evolved nonlinear field, of course you're going to be massively wrong on small scales, okay? But all he needs to do here is saying I have an evolved nonlinear field at mean density. I'm going to look at how would this evolved linear field change if it was actually riding on top of overdense, and just use the SPT for that step, okay? And for that step, it's just kind of like mapping. It is delta goes to delta plus one plus nu two, whatever, right? And then you can connect it to this thing. That's why it works so well. But of course, when you go to hydro, you also get the massive error. So this is in approximation where kind of this thing is exact, right? We know this thing is not like when you have the real variance, you have like
the radial dependence should really depend on nonlinear.
Yeah, exactly. That was my biggest change, right? I think that this point maybe I've looked actually in fact slightly more off. Like my student, okay. My postdoc just had me the thinking. But on real space, we test them a lot. And on real space, it's kind of mind blowing that it works so well. Okay.
Questions?
So does it the new two like 34, 33?
Yeah, exactly. So
does that matter?
Exactly. I had another plot which I threw away. If you replace this 34 with zero, which is effectively I'm going to throw away second order part, right? There's still a little bit of first order part. This black line looks like this. Okay, so going from here to something which is percent level, you need 34 over 21, right?
So that's derived in like a spherical overdensity, and then how does that couple to my small scale? And really, you're talking about along the skewer.
No, along the skewer thing doesn't matter, right? Here we're talking about kind of big volume, right? Skewer is just kind of sampling.
If you did the calculation for like I have a skewer that's on a large scale, and how does that couple to the small?
Because measuring the bias parameter is like the fact that the data coming skewers is dependent from a theoretical prediction of the bias, right? We agree with that.
But I think the orientation of the modes do, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I even said, okay, maybe this 34 over 21 can kind of renormalize to get a better fit, and basically wants to be exactly 34 over 21. It's like pretty magic. But the other thing is, like, if you use the same theory to predict the bias for, like, delta squared fields or delta cubed fields, okay, it works to, like, 10% level, right? It works for this thing, which is kind of right quantity much better, right? So maybe it's something to do with the fact that exponential picks up certain things for which it works better.
Okay, thank you, Andrew.